before we get into class two, what does intertestamental mean?
Between the testaments.
Like an interstate is a road between two states, or a road that takes you between two states. An intertestamental class is going to be that class that takes us from the Old Testament, from the very edge of it, into a 500-year period that'll get us caught up with the New Testament. Because this is not what the world looked like in Christ's time. So you have to somehow get from this to the Roman Empire being in effect. Well, Rome at this point was a little dot under the control of the Etruscans. So how did they ever get to become a world power? And why is Greece so small if they Hellenized the known world at the time? And so all of that is what this class explores. A lot of these notes is going to come from this book, Between the Testaments, by Charles Pfeiffer. He did an excellent job of summarizing all of the key points for this class. And again, I am indebted to Kyle Campbell and his material because it has been very beneficial in putting together this class. A lot of the notes that you're using are derived from what he has put together. So he's been a very big help in that. And I want to give him credit where credit is due. Lesson one covered who in particular? Covered Cyrus. And what can we attribute to Cyrus if we're going to look at Cyrus?
He
let him go back to build the temple. In particular, and that's what he did for the Jews. In particular, what he did for the Persian nation is he founded them, didn't he? He's the one who established them. And we can see on the map here that whenever he did, he put Persia on the map. And just as Daniel chapter 7 and verse 5 talks about, the bear raised up on one side, it's the Medo-Persian Empire, and it had three ribs in its mouth. Those three ribs, it's nothing mystical at the end of time. It's referring to the Persian Empire and the three ribs in its mouth. And it is going to, as we can see over the course of time, it's going to consume each one of those ribs. And by the time we reach 538 BC, it's already consumed Lydia and Babylon. And so that's what that was prophesied about, is Cyrus conquering these times. Who were we introduced to next?
Alexander.
Not yet.
Oh,
Cambyses. Yes, Cambyses. And we see that Cyrus was unable to take Egypt. He had died before that point. He had plans to conquer Egypt. And Cambyses, his son, went after him. And so if you write down anything besides Cambyses, what would you write? He is the occupier of Egypt. He conquers Egypt. And so by 522, we see them consume Egypt as well. So Cambyses that was what really made him notable. However, he didn't have a very long reign. He actually tried to campaign further south into Ethiopia, but was unable to do that because someone usurped him, who was Pseudo-Smerdis, or he goes by the name of Gamada, or actually took his dead brother's name, Bardia, which was a smudge at Cambyses. However, he was...
John, that sounds easier to keep up with.
Do what?
Let's name him John.
There you go, Bob. We'll call him Bob. He was murdered by those loyal to Cambyses. And so who takes the throne then?
Darius.
Now, is this Darius in Daniel chapter 6?
Different Darius.
It has to be a different Darius because he was old. When Darius the Mede came to the throne of Babylon, it mentions his age. And if you were to add that to from Cyrus all the way down to Darius the First, that's an old guy getting on that throne. And so that's not the same Darius. Darius the Mede was probably the general who conquered Babylon and then became regent while Cyrus was campaigning elsewhere. And so that's who this Darius is. Darius the First, however, is going to come much later, who Daniel is long dead by this point, and he comes to the throne. What was Darius known for?
The government, it's a lot like our form of government.
Well, he is, actually, no, but that's good. He established a government that was brutal.
Yeah, brutal.
He did establish, yes, he had excellent civil reform, but just because it was efficient doesn't mean I necessarily want to be under it. Because it was reminiscent of the Assyrian way of dealing with things, which you steal, they cut off your hand. If a slave harms a freedman, they kill the slave. Even if he did it by accident, even if he drops a rock or something and it hits him in the foot, he killed the slave. That's the kind of things that the Assyrians would do, and that's the kind of stuff that Darius put into play, and he quelled rebellions because of it. They stopped what they were doing. So he was a very good civil manager because he didn't tolerate any forms of rebellion. He invented, or he was the first person in recorded history to have any type of Pony Express, where young men would who were well known for their riding capabilities would ride. And he was able to deliver letters in weeks rather than months, which was a big, big part of managing his empire. I do want to show you a few pictures. Pasargadae, I mentioned, is where Cyrus the Great is actually buried. And this is a picture of his tomb right here. And you can go there today, and it's actually pretty big. It's bigger than it looks in the picture. That first step is about not quite the height of a full-grown person, but it's a pretty good height. So that's a pretty big tomb. Alexander actually, whenever he got there, actually paid tribute to Cyrus the Great when he got there. We find, I mentioned the Behistun inscription last time as well, and this is it up on a mountainside. It's kind of hard to see, but it's right in here. And then you can see this is what the inscription looks like. Here's Darius right here. I know that's probably kind of hard to see. I could click on the pictures. I'd be glad to show you these pictures after class. He has his foot on Pseudosmerdis or Gamata as his triumph over him. These are his arms bearers, and these are captives that he would have had. There are three inscriptions there, remember. They are inscribed in Old Persian, Babylonian, and Elamite. And it is the main road between Baghdad, which would be what ancient city? Baghdad, Babylon, and Tehran, which is in the middle of what ancient empire?
Persia.
So it was the main road between Babylon and Persia. There's this big inscription written in all of these ancient languages, basically declaring how powerful Darius was. Alright, he goes and he fights against the Scythians, you'll remember that, and he was unsuccessful, because the Scythians were fighting them in their own territory as suicide. No one would be able to conquer the Scythians. He goes to war against Greece, and we mentioned a phalanx. I want to show you a picture of a phalanx so you have an idea of what exactly that looks like. And the phalanx is going to be one of the reasons that not only the Greeks were able to fend off Persia, but why they would go on to defeat Persia is because of a phalanx. And you can see from this picture right here, it'll probably get bigger in just a second. There we go. You can see in this picture right here that you have lines of soldiers in this cube shape or a square shape. And the ones in the front would put their spears way out in front of them. And if you have another phalanx here, and another phalanx here, and another phalanx here, as long as your phalanx line is longer than the people you're fighting, they can't get close to you. They cannot break through the spears. And so if they happen to get any closer, the second and or the fourth and fifth groups would lower their spears. So you're running into just waves of spears. And it is one of the reasons why the Greeks would be put on the map, why they would actually carve out an empire for themselves. And Darius was defeated at the Battle of Marathon, which has named what race? The Marathon. The Boston. No, the Boston Marathon gets its name from the run from Marathon, which is how many miles?
26.
26. All right, that sums up lesson one. We're going to find that Xerxes the First, you know him from the Book of Esther as Ahasuerus. He is actually going to be the successor to Darius. And he is going to have it out for Greece because of the defeat that they gave his father. And so that's what he's going to do. So we're now getting into lesson number two. If you want to go ahead and follow along, Xerxes and the attempted conquest of Greece. He had been carefully groomed by Darius to do this exact thing. And whenever he was 35, he succeeded his father. The land of Egypt was in rebellion. The Greeks were fighting against him. So he quells Egypt, he quells Babylon, and he goes after Greece. So he will largely be known for his war with Greece. It begins with him recruiting his army from, again, over 46 nations. You can imagine how many soldiers Xerxes had working for him and working with him. He gave the Greeks the opportunity to submit to him, to surrender. And this was done with a sign of earth and water. They could give a tribute, a jar of earth and a jar of water, basically saying, our land and our water is yours. We submit to you. And the Greeks didn't like that. They said, no, we're not going for it. That's not going to happen. And so Athens and Sparta, it's worth noting, they form a coalition to fight. The reason that we point out that they formed a coalition is, what was the state of the Greek cities at this time? They're all independent. That Thebes was a Greek city, but it was not affiliated or governed by Athens, was not affiliated or governed by Sparta, was not affiliated or governed by Corinth, and on and on and on. All of these Greek cities, Syracuse, Rhodes, they were all their own cities. They were not under one foundational government. They were each their own government. And so you understand then, whenever Persia is trying to invade them, you have all of these little city-states trying to fight one by one against this Persian Empire. What would be the chance that they would succeed? And you would think, well, they couldn't. And that's how it begins. Early battles for Greece were disastrous. They failed. And there were two battles of, in particular, rather, there's three that we're going to mention here. Battle of Thermopylae. Have you ever heard of the 300 Spartans? Recently been, I don't know if you want to call it popularized or infamized by the movie 300. That's a dramatization of the Battle of Thermopylae, where the Spartans met a huge Persian army at a location known as the Hot Gates. And it's a very narrow passage between the sea and rocky cliffs. A phalanx can hold that ground for as long as you want them to, as long as they need to. But if you get around behind them, you can beat them. And that's what happened, is that a Greek betrayed them, showed them a goat path. The Persians were able to surround them. Well, the Greeks found out about it before they were completely surrounded, and all the Greeks fled except for 300 Spartans and just a few other Greeks. But they were entirely beaten. However, the Battle of Salamis is a different matter. The Battle of Salamis should have been an overwhelming Persian victory. The Persian navy was much larger, much stronger than the Greeks. However, at Salamis, the Greeks pulled out a decisive win, which caught the Persians completely by surprise. After this, it really rallied the Greeks into one big coalition to fight against the Persians. And after Xerxes fails to beat the Greeks at Byzantium, he has to give up. He has to surrender this. I did want to show you a picture of Xerxes' ship bridge that he built across the Hellespont. He actually had to build a bridge to march this massive land army across a vast body of water. And so what he did is he lassoed all of these boats together and actually built a road across them. And he marched his soldiers across this bridge. That's how he was able to invade Greece with such a large army. That bridge didn't last long. It was not permanent, and it broke, and he lost a lot of men when it did. And he was not happy about that, of course. Go ahead.
The Greeks had smaller ships, but they were very strong in the bow.
Mm-hmm.
And they would charge and knock holes in those ships.
Mm-hmm.
And the armor and what the Persians were wearing was very heavy. And if they fell in the water, they couldn't swim. And thousands of them drowned.
Certainly.
It was really an interesting battle.
Yeah, the way a trireme works, a trireme is the design of the ship that they would use. It had, both at the front and the back, it had a large metal, what looks like an axe head. I think that's the best way to describe it. And the way they would fight is they would sail right up next to that ship, and they would snap the oars off, or all of the oars off of it, so it couldn't move anywhere. And they would row around, and then they would charge the side of the ship, and they would split it in half. Well, if you have all of these triremes doing that all at the same time, you're going to have a bunch of sitting ducks out there. And so that's how they're able to win, certainly. All right, Xerxes in the Bible. Let's go ahead and look at, I think it's your second page of your handout. And what we find is our map is going to change a little bit. If you see, the Persians had invaded what would become Thrace. All of this in here has been invaded. We're going to find that if we fast forward closer to the end of Xerxes' reign, that he's actually going to lose control of that territory. He's not going to be able to hold it. We're also going to see the establishment of some Greek independent cities, which are going to unite later under Philip of Macedon. So we're going to see him by the end of this lesson as well. All right, so there you see Epirus, Macedonia is now on the map. Thrace is on the map. All of this coastline of Asia Minor is now, it's Greek. They had retaken a lot of territory. And all of those islands in there, Crete, all of that is Greek now instead of being under Persian control. So whenever Persia lost to the Greeks, they were able to continually push them all the way back across the Hellespont, which is right in there. So they lost a lot of territory. Ezra chapter 4 and verse 6 is the only biblical reference which bridges the 58-year period between the dedication of the temple and the arrival of Ezra in the 7th year of Artaxerxes. And Xerxes seems to have been too busy to really worry about the Greeks after this. And you can read about his story. And the Jews that did not go back to Judah, that did not go back to Judea, you can read about that in the book of Esther. That's where you're going to find Xerxes. So if you're mapping out in your mind kind of where you are in your Bible, at least up to this point, you can still map out where you are in your Bible. That's going to change by the end of the lesson. All right, any other questions, any comments to be made on Xerxes? He was killed by the one who would succeed him, Artaxerxes I. Actually, never mind. Scratch that. He was murdered by Artabanus, not by his successor. Artaxerxes killed that man and became the leader of Persia. All right. Most historians date the decline of Persia from the reign of Artaxerxes I. Not really because he was just that bad at managing. It's just that the empire was in decline. You find that they were not able to beat the Greeks. They wasted a lot of money and manpower trying to do that. So Artaxerxes, trying to work with this, he doesn't have much to work with. And so that's what his is known for, is just trying to put down rebellions. The disturbances in Egypt gave Artaxerxes more cause for concern. The Greeks were trying to assist the Egyptians. However, the Persians were victorious, again, at a great loss of resources and life. So let's then look at Artaxerxes and the Jews. What Jew in particular had a lot to do with Artaxerxes?
Ezra.
Which other Jew? The cupbearer to the king. Nehemiah is going to be right in front of Artaxerxes I as his cupbearer, and he's going to have, remember, a sad countenance, and Artaxerxes is going to ask him, "What's wrong with my cupbearer? What's going on?" And so he's going to answer him and say, "Well, my city lies in ruins. Why shouldn't I be sad?" And so he asks him, "What's your request?" And one of my favorite passages of the Bible is in that moment between asking him what his request is and him saying what his request is, he says, "I said a prayer to the Lord." That's how quick a prayer can be. Is it can be 3 seconds long. It can be 5 seconds long. And that's just, to me, neat. But that's a side. So we can see that Ezra requested permission from Artaxerxes to lead a fresh group of Jews back to Judea. He gathered 1,500 Babylonian Jews, a group of colonists. He's going to bring with him gold, silver, and temple utensils, and they're going to start out on a journey. They get there, and they have a big part to play in reestablishing the temple and the worship of the temple. So Ezra went to work very, very soon after getting there. Nehemiah later is going to come, and he's going to build what? He's going to build the walls. He's going to give Jerusalem a defense. Not just a temple, not just something for the enemies to eye like a piece of meat. He's going to give them protection. And so we find that he returns there. All right, so all of that is where Artaxerxes, this is what we're looking at. That's where he is in your Bible. Again, not going to be able to do that by the end of the lesson. Actually, our next point is going to point out that that's pretty much the end of your biblical history. Malachi, Zechariah, they're in the time of Nehemiah. They're in the time of I almost said Esther. Nehemiah and Ezra. They're in that time. And so Malachi is going to tell them, okay, the temple has been restored. You need to worship in it the way you're supposed to. You don't need to be worshiping in it in a defiled way. We're going to find that Haggai and Zechariah are going to urge people to not be idle, but to worship God again, to go and restore that temple worship. Those prophets at the very end of your Old Testament are going to be in this time period. They're going to be right in this reign. So it's important to note at the end of letter D, you're going to see it say, with this, both the book of Nehemiah and the history of the Old Testament come to a close. This is important, because beyond this point, you are now truly in the intertestamental period. Up to this point, you can label it Old Testament history if you want. But now we're no longer in Old Testament history. We are officially in intertestamental history, because you're not going to be able to find this in your Bible. Does that mean it's not important? Certainly not. This is one of the ways that we can tell that this book in front of you is indeed inspired. It's because we look at the history of what happened, and it lines up with exactly what Daniel said. It lines up with exactly what these prophets would say would come. That's important to note, that if we see four major empires form, then we know Daniel was indeed inspired of God. And that's important to note. So this time period, despite being extra-biblical, does not mean it is any less important. It certainly is. It especially gives us a framework for seeing where the synagogue came from, where the Pharisees and Sadducees came from, where did the Romans come from. That's what it's for. All right, let's look at the end of the Persian Empire. End of the Persian Empire. Darius II, his reign was one of intrigue. It was one of corruption. What he is going to do is he's actually going to probably do more against the Greeks than Xerxes did, because he's actually going to be bribing and spending Persian gold to incite the Athenians against the Spartans, which led to what war? And the Peloponnesian. Peloponnesian. The island right here, I think it looks like a hand. You can disagree if you want, but I think that looks like a hand and that looks like a foot, but that's just me. The hand shape right here is going to be the Peloponnesus. And this region right here, you see this colored portion at the bottom of it? That's where Sparta is, and that's the territory under the control of Sparta. If you zoomed in, it would probably show it, but I'm not going to take the time to zoom in with how slow my computer is. Athens is right in here. You see this discolored portion right here? That's where Athens is. So from here, up through here where Corinth is, up through here over to Athens, this is where the Peloponnesian War is going to take place. That began, and that was started because Darius II was bribing both sides against each other, possibly as a way to maybe do what Xerxes couldn't, is get a foothold in Greece.
In later times, where was Ephesus and, or rather, Corinth? Where was Corinth?
Corinth is going to be right, it's actually, if you want to walk up after class, this colored portion right here, in between this yellow and this yellow, that's where Corinth is. And remember, it's a coastal city, so instead of sailing all the way around the Peloponnesus, they would drag the ships across here so you could go from the Aegean over into this sea right here very quickly and very easily. Now, Ephesus is going to be right in here.
In Asia.
Yeah, it's going to be over here in Asia. So, and that's where, of course, the temple at Artemis was going to be built. By the way, the wonders of the world are a lot of them are being constructed around this time period. So that's important to note as well. Of course, the pyramids were already there. The Hanging Gardens were already there. But we're going to see that, well, we're not going to see in this class, but we're in the time period of the Colossus of Rhodes being built, Mausoleum at Halicarnassus being built, the Temple of Artemis at Ephesus is being built. All of these wonders of the world are being constructed during this time period. So that's worth noting. You hear about the seven wonders of the world. Well, where do they fall in history? Well, this is where they fall in history right here. All right. We find that the Medes rebel against Persia in this time period. Egypt rebels against Persia in this time period. There was a Jewish temple at Elephantine. You may have heard of the Elephantine Jews before. And they were Egyptian Jews who actually had built a temple in Egypt, not in Jerusalem. And so they rejected the idea that they had to go to Jerusalem to worship. They built a temple there at Elephantine in Egypt. And they worshipped God from there. We're actually going to find later on that Onias III, we're going to mention him. And if you have your handout of high priests in your intertestamental time period, you're going to find Onias III. And he was actually recognized as being the true legitimate high priest. And that's worth noting because the high priesthood is going to become an office of intrigue, corruption, and murder is what it's going to become. And so with that said,
which Onias?
Onias III. Okay. The Hasidim would recognize him as the true high priest, but because he went to Egypt, they're going to forsake that claim and instead recognize somebody else. But we'll cover that in a future lesson. It's at this point, however, during Darius II's reign, that we find the temple at Elephantine destroyed. Artaxerxes II, he is the one who succeeds Darius II. And he actually was about to be assassinated, or his brother Cyrus tried to assassinate him. Of course, this is not Cyrus the Great. He's long dead by this point. He pardons Cyrus, and Cyrus raises an army, partially of Greeks. He brings a lot of mercenaries with him, and he tries to fight against his brother. At the Battle of Cunaxa, you may have heard of the 10,000, which are the Greeks that Xenophon wrote about. And these Greeks are in the middle of Persian territory, and they have to find a way to get back home out of hostile territory to Greece. And it is known as one of the greatest books of military science of the ancient world. So that's worth noting as well, that that's whenever this time, that happened during this time period as well.
I know this is a dumb question, but you refer to the Jewish temple at Elephantine.
Mm-hmm.
How many Jewish temples were there?
This is the only one that I know of that was that was actually established other than the one at Jerusalem. What we're going to find by the end of this lesson is that the synagogue is what Jews had established instead. And that's what made kind of the difference between the temple at Elephantine and the synagogues all over the place, is that no sacrifices or anything were actually made at synagogues. But at the temple at Elephantine, they had an altar. They had everything like you would expect to find at Jerusalem. They just wouldn't go to Jerusalem to do any of that. So you could kind of consider them kind of like the Samaritans, that they wouldn't go to Jerusalem to worship. All right, let's go ahead and look at Artaxerxes III. More notes on Artaxerxes II are there for you. You can read over those that will fill you in on a little bit more of his reign. It was largely rebellion. That's what a big piece of these empires are going to be now. I'm going to jump forward a few years here. And you're going to notice that every time we jump forward a few years, you're going to find another kingdom rebels. Another kingdom breaks off. So Persia is getting weaker and weaker by this point. So it's worth noting that, yes, they have a lot of territory, but they're not able to hold that territory. And that's important because we're introduced in Artaxerxes III's reign to Philip of Macedon. Philip II in particular, if you're looking at your Macedonian kings on your handout, Philip II of Macedon is the individual we're looking at. He was the father of who?
Alexander.
Alexander, who would become the great conqueror. So you can imagine what our lesson will be on next week. It's going to be on Alexander the Great, and I would encourage you to be here for that. It's going to play a big part in what shapes your New Testament. Not the books themselves, but the history of it. Artaxerxes III was cruel and brutal, but because of what he would do, he actually restored and quelled a lot of rebellions. He's going to restore a lot of order in the Persian Empire. Persia was stronger than it had been in over a century during this man's reign, but Philip II of Macedon was uniting all of Greece under his rule. Because he was doing that, what we're going to find is that Persian gold was no longer an influence. It was no longer a factor in Greece. Because if they saw Persian gold, they knew by the laws, by the decrees of Philip of Macedon, that was treason to use that gold. So you couldn't buy your way into Greek politics anymore because of Philip of Macedon. Now, Philip got where he did, and he is actually going to play a big part in Alexander's success because he's going to develop and master something known as the sarissa. Now, a sarissa is a very, very long spear. I showed you the picture of the phalanxes earlier. Well, Greeks would actually fight each other in these phalanxes. You'd have one phalanx and another phalanx come marching towards each other. It was a very long, drawn-out ordeal. Because that could go on for hours. It could go on for days. Because it wasn't exactly a lethal way of fighting. It's just a very safe and effective way of fighting. This is a sarissa that has been recreated. It's a replica. This is a dory. Now, the dory is the spear that the Greek cities, before they were unified, that's the spear they would use. So this is what is known as a hoplite, and this is what's known as a phalange, or a phalangite. This phalangite is going to form the backbone of the phalanxes of Macedon. He has a distinct advantage, because he would be able to hit his opponent long before his opponent could ever strike him back. Philip of Macedon mastered this and perfected this style of fighting, which is going to play a big part in fighting against Persia, who did not have phalanxes. They had mobs of soldiers. Well, if you have phalanxes, an organized fighting force against that, you're going to be able to beat them. Because of that, Philip is able to succeed. He unites all of Greece. Artaxerxes III and his successor is actually poisoned by a eunuch, which leads to Darius III. He becomes king of Persia in 336 BC, and if it wasn't ominous enough, that same year, 20-year-old Alexander would ascend to the throne of Greece. He would ascend to the throne, actually, of Macedon. And if you just think back in history, if Darius knew what was going to happen, oh man, how lucky is he to know that Alexander the Great is going to be coming into his own at the same time that you're coming into yours? Oh, man. He must have thought, Of course, we're going to find whenever he fights against Alexander, he thinks, I'm going to kick this kid around. I'm going to mop the floor with him. That's not what happened. We're going to find that in 333 BC, Darius is defeated in a very important battle. This battle is the Battle of Issus. That's the Battle of Carchemish, is where Babylon and Egypt defeat Assyria, and Babylon then becomes the chief empire over Assyria. The Battle of Issus is going to be the chief battle whenever Persia is going to become, it's going to lose its status as the world power. Greece is then going to be known as the world power. So as you can see on the map in front of you, this is what you're looking at. Macedonia is now this big green portion of Greece. All of it is united. All of these little islands in here are now under that authority. So Sparta tends to hold its own. It's Sparta. So Macedonia is going to then, with Alexander, he's going to invade Persia, and we're going to find that in just 3 years' time, look how far he pushes into Asia Minor. I think it's remarkable, especially since this is a 20-year-old ruler doing this. He retakes the old kingdom of Lydia. If you remember that first map that we looked at, he completely retakes that in 3 years. He is going to continue to carve swaths out of Persia, and he's going to keep on doing that. I also want to point something out to you. Rome is growing. They are no longer under the Etruscans. I don't know if you've been watching them as the maps have been going on, but after 509 BC, Rome was a republic, and they were on the rise. You're going to watch over the course of our other lessons that this little kingdom over here, or I can't call them a kingdom, this little republic over here is going to grow. It's going to grow just like a culture, just like in a petri dish. Watch it. Watch Rome. That's all I can tell you, and I'm going to be pointing them out as we go along. You're going to see them grow. All right, let's look at the problems and progress of the Jews. This is our final section, and then we'll be finished. All right, the problems and progress of the Jews. We're introduced to the Samaritans. Now, the Samaritans were a large group of individuals that were actually brought in and intermingled with the people who were still in the land. Now, this brings what with it?
Different religions,
paganism, all kinds of different things. These are Gentiles that were brought in and mixed with these Israelite people who they were not to intermarry with. They were not even to eat under their house or come into their house or eat with them. So a large number of influential citizens were deported to various cities of the Assyrian Empire. And just like that, colonies of non-Jews from Babylonia, Syria, and Elam were all settled in Samaria. The idea is to keep them from rebelling. If you mix the populations, they cannot organize to rebel against you. So it's actually a pretty shrewd move. It just doesn't make people happy in general. From the earliest days of resettlement after Babylonian captivity, the Samaritans and the Jews were at each other's throats. And a lot of this is recorded for you in the book of Nehemiah. A lot of this is recorded for you in the book of Nehemiah. You can also see this in your New Testament during whose ministry? Between the Samaritans and the Jews.
Christ.
You can see this in Christ's ministry. In particular, there was a woman at the well, and Jesus asks her for what?
Drink water.
What does she say to him?
She says, Jews don't have anything to do with Samaritans.
Absolutely. She says, me? Are you talking to me? I'm a Samaritan. You should know better than to talk to me. We don't associate together. And so he would go on to show her that not only was he a prophet, but that he was something more than a prophet at that point. And so we find that it's noteworthy that Jesus saw fit to go through Samaria and to show his disciples that they were not to allow restrictions placed upon preaching the gospel to the Samaritans. And those notes are for you there. Luke 10, 17, John 4, all of those, or Luke 10, Luke 17, and John 4, all of those sections indicate that as well. And if you'll remember in Acts chapter 1, Christ told his disciples in verse 8 that they would be his witnesses starting in
Judea,
going to
Samaria.
They're going to go to Samaria.
And then into the whole world.
And then into the uttermost part of the earth. So we find that he told them at that moment, you're going to be my witnesses, starting in Jerusalem, going to Judea and Samaria. He wanted them to hear the gospel. He still cared about their souls. Let's look at the Jews at Elephantine. The Jews of Elephantine. It was a Jewish community. It was probably a military installation during Manasseh's reign. Now, was Manasseh a good king, bad king?
Both.
Both. A good answer. He's known for being a
bad
king. He also happened to have one of the longest reigns in Judah's history, despite the fact that during most of his reign he was as wicked as it indicates in particular that he was actually more wicked than the Gentile kings around him. But at the end of his life, what did he do?
He repented.
He changed his ways. And so that's probably when this got established, is when these Jews were put here. Many ancient papyri were discovered in the early 20th century, written between the years 494 and 400 BC. The most interesting document is a letter written in 407 BC, addressed to Bigvi, the governor of Judah. It tells how Egyptian priests, with the connivance of the local governor and the active assistance of the governor's son, destroyed the temple which the Jews had built at Elephantine. Now understand, up to this point, nobody in modern history knew about a temple at Elephantine. And then you read about the Jews had a temple in Elephantine? What's going on?
Where is Elephantine?
Elephantine is going to be down here in Egypt. I could find the exact location for you if you wanted to know. Yeah, so it's going to be down here in Egypt while the other temple is going, well, right about there. So, two locations where you're going to go to worship God. So, the Jews did not like this. They rejected the concept of a single central sanctuary as the place in which sacrifices to Yahu, as they called him, or Yahweh, must be brought. They did not deem it necessary to take sides in the conflicts between Jerusalem and Samaria. Largely, those conflicts were focused on what? Between Jerusalem and Samaria. How'd that get started? The Jews wouldn't let the Samaritans help build what?
The temple.
And so the Jews at Elephantine built their own temple. So they're saying, look, y'all need to settle that and worship at your own two locations. They said, quit trying to go to one temple here. Divide. So that's what they did. That's why the Jews in Jerusalem hated them. They did not like that fact, so much so that if a priest went there, they were disbarred. I guess that's the best way to put it. They were no longer able to practice. They were excommunicated. They were no longer able to work as a priest ever again for going to Elephantine. This introduces us to the synagogue as well. The synagogue is mentioned. During this time between the Testaments, the synagogue and its worship became the focal point of Jewish life through the centuries. Now, why is that? 586 BC, what happened to the temple? The temple was wiped out by Nebuchadnezzar. It was completely destroyed. And any temple built after that, Zerubbabel's temple, or Nehemiah's temple, Ezra's temple, was just a shadow compared to that. And so these Jews were scattered all over the place, none of them able to necessarily get back home to where they were, especially during these first times of captivity. And so what do? They build synagogues. Go ahead.
It's interesting that in the Bible there is never any authority given to build synagogues.
Mm-hmm.
However, it appears that Jesus accepted the synagogue as being a place where Jews came to worship and he would go and preach there. So it seems to be part of God's will. In this interim period.
Certainly. And you can look at it this way. We mentioned the ideas of specific and generic authority. What were they taught to do for their children, and for what were they taught to do with the law in general? Deuteronomy chapter 6, they were to study it. They were to teach their kids. They were to think about it when they rise up, when they lay down, when they walk in the way. They were to study it. What was the synagogue designed to do?
Study the word.
To study the word. So, does it matter how they go about studying the word?
Since it's generic.
It's a generic sense of authority. But, should they study the word? Yes, they're not to study how to do their taxes to Persia. They're not to study how to just go about building a better business. They are to study the law. They are to study what God had given them. And so there's where the authority still comes into play, but it's generic. They didn't have to build a synagogue. They could have come up with a different system. They chose to do it through synagogues. It's of Greek origin. The word itself is of Greek origin, meaning a gathering or a congregation of people. The chief article of furniture in the synagogue was the ark, containing the scrolls of the law and other sacred writings. The ark stood by a wall farthest from the entrance, and in the center of the synagogue was a raised platform known as the bima, on which was placed a lectern, kind of like this one right here. And so what they would do is the chief seats were close to the ark, facing the people, and as a rule, the front of the synagogue faced Jerusalem. Synagogue worship was doubtless very simple in its early history. The elements of prayer and the reading and explanation of a portion of the scripture was part of the service from the earliest days. And you can see this in Christ, in his time in the synagogue, which, again, as I think Rand pointed out, and he did a good job of doing so, is that it seems to be part of the will of God, because Jesus would go into the synagogues and he didn't denounce the synagogues. He went in there and used that as an opportunity to teach. What did Paul do?
Same.
He did the exact same thing. He would go to the synagogues and use that as an opportunity to teach.
Do you think it was somehow that they knew that it was all right to build the first synagogue? I mean, what do you think was going on?
I think, if you ask me, I think it was a lot like how Wednesday night, in my mind, got started. A lot of Jews wanted to get together, read God's Word together, so they all come in, into one spot. Well, there was probably, because of Babylonian captivity, so many of them brought together in one spot that they thought, you know, we should probably just build a location that we can all meet in. And so, in my own thinking, that's probably how it got started, is that they wanted to study together. They met on the Sabbath day, so that was a day in which they would dedicate to the Lord to read His Word and things like that. So they probably decided, you know, it would be better to do it together than do it alone, especially in a land that was not your own. I imagine that's how it got started. Especially since they couldn't congregate at the temple anymore, because it was no more. No more. Xerxes and Artaxerxes and some of the last rulers that we looked at, Darius II, Artaxerxes II, and III, these individuals saw the end of the Persian Empire. And during this time, the Jews developed certain characteristics that are very important to your New Testament. In the next lesson, we're going to look at Alexander the Great. We're going to look at his what he believed, his purpose, his mission from the gods. We're going to see how he went about his conquest. We're going to see what follows that conquest. Because he only lived a few decades. He didn't live very long. He was 20 when he came into his power, and he died in his 30s. Imagine what would happen if he lived any longer. He would have been in China by then. But with that said, we're going to look at him next time. Again, these lesson notes come from Between the Testaments by Charles Pfeiffer. I recommend picking it up. It will largely talk about everything that we have talked about. If you need an Old Testament history handout, or rather a Kings of the Ancient World or Kings of... or the High Priest, if you need that, feel free to pick those up. We can print you out that very quickly. That will aid you in your study. That's all I had prepared, so if you have any questions or any comments, anything at all.
You know, I still am going back to this idea of how they stepped out in the synagogue. You know, it was very specific about the temple.
Mm-hmm.
When God gave them total instructions about that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just kind of hard for me to imagine what happened. I mean, there was no more temple, obviously,
mm-hmm.
but why didn't they think, well, we need to build a new temple? You know, why didn't they go to synagogue? That just bothers me.
I don't know. I don't know. I couldn't tell you.
Because it was a big departure from
mm-hmm.
what he had told them to do.
Well, what you'll find, too, is that whenever it talks about the temple, I think that was largely Solomon's plan. That wasn't necessarily written in their book of the law. I'm sure they had the measurements and everything that they were supposed to follow, but that was kind of a later addition given to Solomon. They may have looked at it that way. I don't know.
Also, they were Judah was conquered during this time. They weren't their own country. They couldn't do what they wanted to do.
Yeah.
Babylonian had destroyed it, which showed that Nebuchadnezzar and his followers didn't want it rebuilt.
And that could,
and then
that
when
be.
the Persians came in, they didn't want to rebuild until Cyrus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, until
Cyrus. And then when it was destroyed again, that country didn't want it rebuilt. So it would have been difficult to go rebuild the temple.
Certainly, and yeah, they were not able to just choose when they got to do what they wanted to do. They could live in the land, they could work in the land, but a temple would probably have a unifying look to it, and that probably would not bode well, especially since Nebuchadnezzar, I mean, we read about him setting up an image in his own worship, or worship of himself, and so he exalted himself kind of high, which Isaiah talks about when he calls him that O Shining One, or Lucifer. He talks about how he exalts himself, and that's exactly what Nebuchadnezzar did throughout his reign. So I think Julie had a...
Under whose reign was the temple
in Palestine? Let me see real quick if I can just look through here. Well, the group probably got there around 650, but somewhere between 494 and 400. So that's kind of a 94-year period. So there was probably a few kings in there that could have been reigning. So I don't really think they're sure, but it would have been during the time that 494 to 400. So you're looking at the time from
the Persian.
Yeah, Darius the First, all the way to Artaxerxes. Well, Artaxerxes the Second. So that's I know that's a big period of time, but it would have been the Persian rulers.
So it was after Cyrus
allowed them to rebuild. Yes. So the temple was already built, and then you see Jews go down there and build a temple. So the Jews in Jerusalem are probably like, hey, you can't do that.
Can I ask one other thing? I miss the idea of that bear. I have is there any way you could go back to that?
Yeah. Yeah, let's look at the bear one more time.
Right.
I missed him the first time.
It's in Daniel.
Yeah.
I know, but on the picture, I'm talking about on the map. I mean, later I've seen the bear, but I couldn't see him at first.
It's like that picture of the two faces in the vase. It's like, the bear, don't you see the bear?
Yeah, but if you're color deficient, that's a problem.
Hey, that's true. So, Persia here, from Daniel 7 and verse 5, it talks about, Daniel 7:3 mentions, four beasts rising up out of the sea being the nations, all of the people of the world. And Persia is one of those beasts. It is the bear. It's raised up on one side because it was made up of largely two conglomerate of empires, the Medo-Persian Empire. Well, the Persians were stronger than the Medes, so the bear is raised up on one side. Later on in Daniel's prophecies, you will read about a ram with one horn bigger than the other. Well, that's the Medo-Persian Empire. This ram, or this bear, right, raised up on one side, has one, two, three ribs in his mouth. And so, and that's what the passage discusses, is the ferocity of Persia in conquering those territories. And so when you go on to read, since we're there, I guess we are done with the lesson. I should probably stop that recording, but it talks about, in verse 6, "After this I beheld, and lo, another like a leopard, which had upon its back four wings of a bird," which is a wing is a sign of swiftness. Well, this one had four. So what does that tell you about Alexander's empire? How quick is it going to come? It's going to hit them like lightning, that in the course of 10 years, 12 years, he is going to take all of that territory and then some. So that's the idea of the wings there behind this leopard with four wings. The beast had four heads, and dominion was given to it because there would be four generals that would rise up and form the Diadochi after, and we're getting in the next class, but that's where this bear and his three ribs come from. The lion that is mentioned there is going to be the one before the bear. Who is before the bear? Babylon. And so then that great beast that is terrible, powerful, and strong exceedingly, with great iron teeth, is going to be Rome. That's going to be Rome. And he mentions that at the end, chapter 7, verse 23, "Thus he said, the fourth beast shall be a fourth kingdom upon the earth." He tells you what he's referring to. He's not leaving it up for me to, well, is he talking about the end times? No, he tells us what he's referring to. It's a fourth kingdom. It's going to be whenever he sets up the Lord's kingdom, which is going to be the church. We had a class, I actually had a sermon on that just a little while ago. Well, that's all I had. I'm going to go ahead and stop the recording. Appreciate everyone's attention.